who are exercising public functions. The result is that a revolution in agriculture in many other phases of life has been carried out under private auspices over the last 100 or 150 years. For short-run gain, we have allowed millions to be uprooted from the soil, pushed into the cities. There's never been anyone deliberate about this. How many people do we want to push into the cities? You adopt the machine for profit purposes, and it has the effect of forcing people into the cities. For short-run gain, we have allowed millions to be uprooted from the soil and pushed into the cities. Through private planning for private profit, we have created giant urban slums and forced millions without consulting them to conform to the rhythm of the machine. Technology, to be sure, has many values which often have been sung, but should it be allowed to develop largely autonomously, regardless of its social consequences? I usually get my grades in late, and they're recorded on machines. One day they were unusually late, and the dean called, and I said, I'll get them in as soon as I can. Then his secretary called again. No, I can't read the handwriting, I said. Finally, the secretary said, can't you give me a tentative date in which your grades will be in? And I said, yes, maybe next Tuesday. And then she said very solemnly, I certainly hope they'll be in by next Tuesday. The machines are waiting. At the same time, criticism of the agrarian and decentralist model ought not to be admitted. It's not all in favor of the decentralist model. Why did human beings flee to the cities in such large numbers? Partly, no doubt, because of the exigencies of earning a living, in which a premium was implicitly placed on larger and larger farms and fewer farmers. But we would be fooling ourselves if we did not recognize in the flight to the cities a repudiation of many characteristics of traditional agricultural life, frequently a narrowness of vision, for example, and the absence of a truly private realm immune to the nosiness of neighbors and very hard and often unrewarding work. Both extreme centralist and extreme decentralist models, with their corresponding divisions of labor, would seem to be defective, and friends, if they seek an optimum way of life, would be wise to explore the possibility of some kind of a third way, one which would avoid the limitations of both the extreme agrarian and the extreme integrationist vision. So we come now to the third point. There are only four, you remember. This would, moreover, be a task which fits nicely into Friend's historic position. Unlike the early Mennonites, I believe I'm correct historically here, most Friends did not believe in withdrawn communities as the only way to seek the kingdom of God. They had as their aspiration to be in the world, but not of it, to live in towns and cities as well as in the country, while seeking to transform them, to accept some considerable division of labor while recognizing the moral dilemmas for the individual which this could cause. And I haven't had time to deal at length with those moral dilemmas. Among the explicitly utopian visions of the 20th century, that of Aldous Huxley in his novel called Ireland would seem to approximate best the notion of the middle way. The story is that of an Englishman who is shipwrecked and finds himself on an island which has a peculiar constitution, yet which is not without conflict itself. It is a society of what we might call selective technology. That is, not all complex technology is rejected, nor is all accepted. Incomes seem to be about equal. The motto might be said to be a sound mind in a sound body. Well, this is one way, in other words, to think of an intermediate stage, such as you find in Huxley. In Paula, the name of the utopia, sex is free and everyone receives free contraceptives to the males every month. Dealing with the difficult task of raising teenagers, the residents of Paula work out a rather ingenious solution. Everyone agrees teenagers are problematic, or maybe you don't, but many people do. During puberty and adolescence, families may trade their young people with one another on the theory that an outsider can best understand what is going on and be more objective, thus befitting not only the young person, benefiting not only the young person, but also his family. The general impression which Paulo leaves on one is that of gentleness and an unhurried life, yet not the rejection of all technology and not extremely simple division of labor. Technology has remained a tool and has not set the pace for life. When I talk with some of the futurists, for example, this seems to be the case. They say this is coming technologically, and the sole question is how you're going to adjust to it, you see. We have to adjust to what's coming, and we've had no voice in saying what we'd like to see coming, because our elections don't deal with fundamental issues at all, of course. You won't find this technological problem being debated this year. But the vision of Paulo ends on a pessimistic note. The conspirators who are seeking to open it up to the wonders of constantly changing life are eventually successful. The traditional way of life ends and petroleum interests take over, with the prospect of capitalism, violence, exploitation, and disrespect for personality. One gathers that the story of Paulo is a kind of parable of 20th century life in general. Often it seeks the golden mean, but seems to be forever frustrated. And this can be one of the questions that friends ask themselves. It is notorious that literary portrayals of heaven are usually attractive and exciting, more exciting than are literary portrayals of hell. Thus Dante's Purgatorio and Inferno draws to them more than the paradise. Perhaps this is in part true because the utopias, or good places, often seem to define goodness as the absence of conflict. But it is conflict of some sort which exemplifies the vital and the creative in human beings. If one envisions the utopia as the elimination of all conflict, no wonder it is dull, no wonder it is inhuman. The first characteristic, then, of a utopia animated by friends' values would be a society and culture in which the level of conflict has been altered, but conflict itself has not been abolished. In other terms, violent conflict has been so circumscribed that only the nonviolent type remains. The difficulty with Huxley's utopia of the middle way, or Paulo, was that it still existed within the context of a society of incipient violence, the conspiracy of the interests of a few within Paulo, with the external forces seeking to subvert the generally gentle and peaceful commonwealth. With this important exception, the Paulans have managed to change the level of conflict without abolishing it. Thus, one gathers that there are still conflicts about ways of viewing the world, world outlooks, tensions between parents and children, sibling rivalries, and the portrayal in literature of alternate value systems. And conflicts within the individual soul, as well as tensions developed in the search for union with the divine, will continue. A second characteristic of such a world would be what we might call its cosmopolitanism. We're still dealing now with projected friends' utopias. While groups of lesser scope than the whole human race, and the whole human race we're calling the ecumene, which is a Greek word meaning the whole inhabited globe, would flourish, the basic socio-political allegiance of the human being would be to the whole human race. Such phenomena as nationalism would be only cultural and not political. Within these limits, competition between and among national spirits or world outlooks will no doubt continue to flourish, adding to the colorful nature of human existence. A third note of this projected world would be its insistence that the discovery of complex, new techniques should be strictly separated from their introduction into the economy and society. I hope I'll have some opponents on this point in the discussion. I'm just eager to get opponents on this point. The farmer would be free, that is, the discovery of the principles behind the technology would not be interfered with, or at least as free as resources permitted, while the latter would be controlled by some popularly chosen agency, which would take it into consideration not only the economic consequences of its introduction, but also its social, psychological, and political results. While this would be no easy task, today we are in the infancy, for example, of public technological assessment, it is an indispensable one if we are to take the human being, make the human being master rather than the servant of his technological destiny. For the most part, we still introduce new contrivances by happenstance, with little assessment of their possible impact on the lives of human beings. This is the way we obtained the handgun, for example. Like some other technology, it's difficult to see what earthly good it fulfilled. Its only purpose was the destruction of human life, and yet it was multiplied enormously. The public and deliberate assessment and planning of technological development would be in conformity with the medieval maxim: whatever touches all should be approved by all. Nothing touches us more than technological development. It should not be allowed to take place without community consent. Fourthly, while there would have to be an overall unity of the human race, together with a corresponding organization, within this ecumenical unity would be an emphasis on administrative, social, and functional decentralization, somewhat along the lines of writers like Schumacher, for example, whom some of you know. The old nation states might continue to be the basic units, but denuded, as we have said, of their militant ideological, political, and military nationalism. They might become units of economic planning, either singly when relatively large or combined with other and smaller nations. Fifthly, the economic system might be designated as a form of democratic socialism. A keynote would be some type of planning in which overall goals would be fixed by the ecumenical assembly, with implementation to be developed by the decentralized political units or the controlled marketplace. I emphasize controlled marketplace. Isn't it obscene the way people bow to the market in the world today, for example? What will the market say, we say. And so why do we allow the market to have such a control over us? It's like technology again. Here it is, a non-living thing whose deliverances we're always looking for. Distribution would be in accordance with the communist principle, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, a perfectly good principle invented by the early Christian church at Jerusalem. In the sixth place, a word should be said about crime. Plato once observed that no one voluntarily does wrong. It is social conditions, psychological disorders, and ignorance which lead humans to do wrong under the belief that it is right. Today there is a tendency in American criminological and legal thought to return to harsh sanctions, including the death penalty. All this is wrong-headed if our goal be the redemption of the individual and the protection of society. Our goal should be the abolition of prison, not its expansion. The eradication of the death penalty, which does not deter crime, as evidence of 150 years indicates, not its reintroduction. Our objective, too, should be that of a basically unarmed police, whose prime task would be the curtailment of crime and not its prevention. Don't mean I want to prevent it. I don't want to prevent it, but not curtailment, but its prevention, rather. When the unarmed police in London were established early in the 19th century, it apparently was on the advice of a former chief of military police who observed that soldiers respected unarmed military police more than they respected those who were armed. A model somewhat like that of the London police gives far better hope for the prevention of crime than all the proposals and harsh measures taken together. Now I come to my fourth point. You survived, most of you. What challenges, then, must we confront on the way to a utopia? I want to conclude with that question. And I have a number. There are many more, but I'd like to single out these. There's first of all the challenge of change. What should be one's attitude to it? Liberals for too long have seemed to say that all change is good, but it isn't. Some change may be bad. Our task is as much to prevent some kinds of change as it is to foment others. But the wisdom to know the difference between the two is not always given to us. At many points, we've referred to the challenge of technology. Do we have the intelligence and will to reverse the present tendency to allow technology to control us through its imperatives rather than our controlling it? Thirdly, then, there is the challenge posed by physical force and the problem of distinguishing its legitimate from its illegitimate use. We ought to give more thought to that question. Both the force required to pull a child from the path of an onrushing automobile, which most of us would approve, I think, and the force exhibited in the explosion of a hydrogen bomb. Both of them represent force in general, but surely they cannot be equated ethically. What's the difference between an ethically approvable use of force and one which is not? How does one distinguish between legitimate force and illegitimate force, or what we call violence? In attaining our vision, no question is more important. There's fourthly the challenge posed by environmental pollution or degradation. It's an enormous problem and cannot be ignored on the road to utopia. We are not clear at every point either of just how it should be handled. But it's a world problem at least as much as it is a national problem. Fifthly, the pressure of population on resources is another challenge on the road to the good place. Even if we agree with some economists and argue that with an efficient economic system and adequate education, we could support many times the existing population, one might well ask whether from the social and political point of view, it would be desirable to live in such a crowded world. The challenge includes that of abortion, which is relied on increasingly in many parts of the world for population control. Can a religious person emphasizing reverence for life support deliberate abortion? That question has not been answered satisfactorily to me. The question will not die so long as millions of embryos and fetuses are deliberately destroyed every year. Friends particularly have often been complacent about such questions, all too often relying on so-called liberal answers, which are hardly adequate. I'm not saying that I have an answer, but I think there needs to be still much more discussion and less dogmatic teaching on either side or all 10 sides of the issue. The vast problem of the manipulation of our genetic composition has so many ramifications you can't possibly all mention them all. Yet it won't be debated in the coming election. See, the most important issues we don't subject to the political process. Yet it is a political issue and it's an ethical issue. The last challenge, and one which overshadows all else, is of course that of a genuinely possible nuclear war. So much has been said about the question that there is hardly anything new to be uttered. The issue is an important aspect of the general challenge of force. The astonishing thing is that most leaders familiar with the enormous power of the contemporary bomb do not believe that it can be effectively used to implement policy, whether the leaders are Soviet leaders or whether they're American leaders. Neither side believes that it can implement policy. It's too destructive. Why then do we continue to test? And how can they possibly be deterrents if it becomes a kind of collective incentive, if it becomes a kind of commonplace to say that no major power would ever use them? If you wouldn't use them, what becomes of the deterrent argument? There's a kind of collective insanity here which I don't have skill enough to analyze fully. Where there is no vision, the people perish. But they will perish too Even with vision, if the immediate challenges of politics and social action are not recognized and met, the road to utopia is a long and hazardous one, beset by many difficulties. In traveling it, we must keep in mind both ends and means, both goals and analyses of methods. Impossible ideals may become possible only if we fully recognize this. But even if the goals are not attained, they will have served as a beacon light for the human being and the human being seeking direction and a safe journey. Thank you.
He's asked you some questions. The discussions will be in room 124 and 125. Thank you.